First case this morning is ProLink Holdings versus Federal Insurance.
May it please the court, I'm David Gauntlet for the appellant. I have 3 points this morning, Your Honor. First, a defamation potentially falling within Federal's 42407 to 42408 personal injury coverage was first uttered after ProLink's entry into the 81707 security agreement with Calliope Capital Corporation when GPS alleged that ProLink publicly proclaimed license rights and an ownership interest in the 518 patent, which ProLink did not possess, according to GPS, thereby calling into question GPS's reputation for veracity when it made contrary public pronouncements. Second, Federal's has stopped from asserting the prior offense condition slash exclusion to bar coverage for personal injury arising out of an offense first committed before the beginning of the policy period under Illinois law, as it was the insurer on risk during the preceding policy period and did not reference this condition exclusion as a grounds for denying a defense, nor did its motion for judgment on the pleadings, which is why we're here today, since that motion was granted, based on that condition exclusion by specifically noticing it to provide a meaningful opportunity to respond. And third, in the alternative, even if estoppel is not recognized, the prior offense condition exclusion cannot bar a defense since there was no meaningful prior injurious personal injury publication of a defamatory statement with defamatory material published as required by the policy by the mere act of recordation of the security agreement of Co-America.
Does
in
your
light
entire
of this court's authority.
Theory here, your theory of coverage, depend upon this underlying complaint being construed as a defamation claim?
You have to find that there is implicit defamation factually asserted in the complaint in order to find potential coverage. The district court appeared to concede that as a possibility because it went directly to the exclusions. One of the dangers that often occurs in this offense-based coverage area is courts often go directly to the exclusions, not articulating with specificity the basis for coverage, which leads to something of a disconnect, which we have here. As to why I think there's...
How is it that you win under the coverage grant, setting aside the exclusions for the moment?
Absolutely, Your Honor.
Because the underlying complaint states a claim for slander of title and unfair competition involving the patent, which are essentially just alternative ways of stating a slander of patent title claim.
There is an articulated label cause of action for slander of title, but labels are of no moment under applicable precedent
right,
for this court.
Under what theory is this a defamation? It's not personal to the company or anyone at it.
You can defame
at the patent.
Well, you can defame a corporation as well as libel it, Your Honor. In fact, the district court recognized, citing in its decision, the restatement second of torts, one who publishes defamatory matter concerning a corporation is subject to liability if the matter tends to prejudice the corporation in the conduct of its business or to deter others from dealing with it. And because the defamation coverage is of a person or organization, that's what it specifically provides. It's not limited to defamation of the person. If you look at the Laserage case, American Insurance Laserage, 1998, by Illinois law, the court said it seems obvious to this court that wrongfully asserting that a competitor's product infringes patent clearly defames the competitor and disparages its product. So we have the reverse situation here of that. In NVIDIA, a district court decision citing a Seventh Circuit published decision of this court stated it affirmed the judgment against defendant for defamation under Illinois law where the defendant falsely claimed that plaintiff was violating its patent and trademark rights. So when you impugn, call into question the public pronouncements of GPS that it had a patent, it occupied the field, it could exclude others, by your statements in the marketplace, that statement can create a distinct basis for liability. And it's simply a situation where you have double duty. It's both disparagement and defamation.
But the claims were simply alleging that your client made false statements about its rights to the patent.
Which harmed the reputation of the claimant, as it alleged, as well. And because of that, the possibility exists that there could have been a basis for indemnity flowing from defamation. It is not the case. And if you look at our reply brief, we cite three cases which they claim were only disparagement cases. And if you look carefully at those opinions, one of them's LaserAge, another Miranda, another OSI, the court clarified that defamation was also implicated there.
Reputational harm is not the gravamen of the offenses in the underlying complaint. What is the business harm.
Well, with all due respect, Your Honor, the gravamen of the case is of no moment, as Judge Posner found in 1994 analyzing an antitrust case, and the Tenth Circuit recently found in Dish Network in a published opinion reversing the district court. The question is whether there's any potential for coverage, which is a far different standard. The Illinois Court of Appeal in Lorenzo v. Capital Indemnity Corporation said the threshold a complaint must meet is minimal. All we're talking about is whether there's a possibility that the case could have proceeded on the facts alleged to an indemnification basis where defamation was alleged as a basis for coverage. And the fact that you claim that somebody made disparaging statements can prove defamation. Indeed, you can read a case brought by a federal insurance case against Golden Eagle, so noting at 2007 WL1851667 at asterisk 5. I've cited a number of decisions where the same facts impugning the legal protestations or legal rights that one company claims to have can create a possible implicit defamation claim. And the fact that there was some ambiguity about how clear that defamation claim was in the articulated pleading under the Ainsworth decision, a Court of Appeal decision from Illinois, permits that ambiguity to be clarified by reference to the press releases, which are Exhibits 3 and 4 to our coverage complaint, and properly before the Court on this motion to dismiss the coverage complaint in its entirety. And therein, the CEO of GPS claimed that they were trying to clarify their rights, and Prolink said, Prolink has achieved a dominant market presence by providing a superior experience and product to our golfers, golf course customers, suppliers, and partners. They couldn't do that, according to the claimant, because they had no rights to have such a product in the marketplace. And that calls into question claiming superiority, suggests that the other products are also inferior. Judge Bauer had a thoughtful decision on this issue dealing
with Acme. I was writing for the court.
Well, I'm talking about the titanium scissors case where there was a lack of obvious reference to the parties and it could be contextually understood in context. But if you look at the two slander of title cases, one from the 11th Circuit, the other from the 10th Circuit, Lime Tree and Bank West, both of them found both disparagement and defamation factually alleged. There are circumstances when slander of title claims can do double duty. This case is also analogous to a Ninth Circuit case against Federal Insurance Company, which they were unsuccessful in at the Court of Appeal, though one at the District Court, called Orofino. There the Court said the underlying allegations could potentially allege a claim for true libel because an allegation that D&W was a patent infringer, a majority of allegation of shady business practice, was implicit in Ormerica's statement that QVC and D&W's gold chains infringed its patents. So this whole context of circumstances where there are questions as to the asserted rights that one has to a patent can bring into focus a possibility where you can defame the party who has questionable rights. Because if I try to license from GPS and find out they don't have the rights they say they do, that is going to impugn their reputation in the marketplace and make it unlikely that they'll have the full benefits that they seek. Certainly that disparages their title, probably the products emanating from the company, as well as defaming the reputation of the corporation. All three can be nested in those same fact patterns. And that's what the potential for coverage standard requires. Otherwise, you're applying an indemnity standard where it does not properly work. In Dish Network, which is a patent coverage case, the court emphasized how you have to deeply dig to look for possible coverage. It says it's not clear from the complaint whether or not DISH is alleged to have infringed advertising-related claims in Rakuten's patents by conveying promotional information. Nonetheless, insurers have not met their heavy burden of proving that the underlying claim cannot fall within policy coverage. I think this case is very analogous to that situation as well. And I just urge the court to read those cases in light of the broad duty to defend standard under Illinois law and rethink whether this is not a situation where the court too narrowly construed the possibility of coverage, creating a potential duty to defend.
We've got three policy exclusions in play here, assuming that arguably there's coverage under the personal injury coverage grant.
Well, the first one requires a prior offense, but the carrier was on risk the prior year as well.
Except you didn't plead that policy.
Well, it was before the court in that's the denial letter referenced both policy years. And then what you would find then is that we've left open the ability to go ahead and sue on it. But here's the problem with that prior year. There was no publication. All we had is a recordation. If you find that that's a publication of material, then you will be contrary to precedent from this court. In Capital Indemnity Court v. Elston, there's no allegation that Elston infringed trademarks prior to the inception of the policy.
What about the intellectual property exclusion and the expected or intended injury exclusion?
Well, expected or intended or injury exclusion, if you look very carefully at the allegations, it's all on information and belief that we had knowledge.
That's not going anywhere.
Well, you're going to have some problems with your prior precedent if you go down that line, because should have known means negligence, as the Park University case affirmed by the Tenth Circuit found. And if you played in the alternative, should have known, that's not enough to show that there were no circumstances where you didn't intend to expect injury. And the focus is not on injury, by the way, in coverage. The focus in the offense-based policy is on whether the offense was committed. You also have on information and belief, the representative was made that defendants had knowledge. So there's no express allegation of knowledge. It's either should have known or information and belief. Further, if you looked at the case authority on expected and intended, and by a Blue Sky Bio, a 2010 WL 5288160-4 distinguishes the Del Monte Seventh Circuit case, because there were only allegations of willful conduct which fell within knowledge of falsity, a different exclusion. And if you look at this court's decision in Cincinnati Eastern Electric, points out that defamation itself doesn't have an inherent intent to injure expectation, and there's no malice requirement because we're only suing a corporation here, and it's not a public figure. Utica Insurance Co. v. David Agency, as in Cincinnati, David could be found liable for defamation under count two without a finding that they knew the statements were false. So you don't have enough by the mere fact that it's defamation to get the expected or intended.
These are intentional torts.
All are intentional torts. They're expressly covered under the offense-based coverage. It covers malicious prosecution. It covers various forms of copyright infringement. If you look at the nature of the offenses, many of them are intentional torts. That's not the question. And if you look at Cincinnati Insurance, they say, yeah, they're intentional torts in the sense that intentional conduct is required, but they don't need to all intend injury. The Tooze decision in 1997 by the Seventh Circuit found illusory, an exclusion that tried to put an occurrence predicate to bar coverage for fact allegations of disparagement and defamation, because it would take away everything that had been granted. The point is that you have to have more than a mere intentional tort. And defamation is not an intentional tort in any simple sense, as both that Seventh Circuit found and as the Court of Appeal in Cincinnati of the American Hardware found. It's a very distinct kind of tort that can be found in certain circumstances to simply be based on recklessness, gross negligence, various other scienters. But if you look at the expected or intended injury, it has to be from the standpoint of the reasonable person. Guess what? There's no indemnity in this case. It was resolved without any liability. Turns out we were probably right. So there's no confession of bad conduct. There's an allegation on information belief that was never proved of purported knowledge of falsity. And this isn't a knowledge of falsity exclusion. They haven't asserted that. It's in the policy. They didn't go there, didn't try to go there in any way. But if you look carefully at Blue Sky Bio, you'll see a very analogous scenario in that situation. And again, the should-have-known allegation suggests in the alternative negativity. All that your court is positing is one circumstance where indemnity could arise, where the exclusion might apply to bar indemnity, but not that it would bar a defense in all possible world. Judge Krowski in Atlanta Mutual v. Lamb, 2002 decision from the California Court of Appeals, looked at the first publication exclusion, and he said, hey, it didn't apply in all possible world, and you have to look at that standard. That's the one you have to look at, and there's a possible scenario where it wouldn't apply, and that makes a difference here. Going back to the notion of whether there was an injurious publication in that prior year, the Second Circuit in Gartner v. St. Paul said, finding no publication were alleged that Gartner misrepresented to ECI that it developed the product independently of ECI's intellectual property. So there can be circumstances that create liability that are not sufficient to fall within the intended and expected or the IP exclusion, because what we have here is a dispute about the right to ownership and licensing of an intellectual property right, not enforcement or assertion of an intellectual property right, when we look at the fact allegations that create defamation. And what the court didn't look at, it didn't look at the fact that the word personal injury was in quotes, so you have to incorporate all the language that creates defamation falling within the offense. Then you look at that and you see if the exclusions take away from that. Well, they don't, because those statements that create defamation are not the kind of conduct that falls within the IP exclusion or the expected and intended exclusion.
You're in your rebuttal argument time, you know.
I'll preserve that, Your Honor.
Mr. Cunningham.
Good morning, and may it please the Court. I'm Dan Cunningham on behalf of Federal Insurance Company. I'll start with the issues surrounding the insuring agreement. We're dealing here with the duty to defend. The policyholder has the burden of proving that the allegations in the underlying complaint potentially satisfy the definitions that are delineated in the insuring agreement. The definition that's most critical here is the one involving personal injury. Personal injury here includes defamation in the form of libel or slander of a person or organization. But then the definition, unlike most insurance policies out there in the market, goes on to provide that coverage is not provided for disparagement of goods, products, property, or services. So the policy speaks in different ways to two different torts: defamation, which is a reputational tort, and disparagement, which is an economic injury-related tort. The former, if facts were actually alleged, would potentially be triggered under the policy. The latter is not. Disparagement of property is not covered under the policy. And the reason that's so important in this case is because all of the allegations go to slander of title. Slander of title is a form of disparagement of property. And in duty to defend related cases, it's the actual allegations that control our analysis. It's not hypothetical, imaginative allegations dreamt up by a policyholder in order to manufacture coverage where none was intended. So if you look at the underlying actual allegations, they all speak to disparagement of property. There's nothing in the underlying complaint that suggests the existence of defamation of a person or organization. Now, because there are no such allegations in the complaint, the policyholder refers to what is referred to in the industry as the implied defamation theory. And they argue that under this theory, we should rewrite the underlying complaint and that Your Honor should rewrite the underlying complaint so as to include a previously unspoken claim for defamation. But again, Illinois resolves the duty to defend based on the actual allegations, as do virtually all other states. Counsel for the policyholder has referenced quite a few cases that have discussed this implied defamation theory, but they're all distinguishable for one very important reason. In every case where implied defamation has been found to exist, there has been an actual allegation in the underlying complaint that the insured said something negative about the claimant. In some of the cases, the insured is alleged to have said the claimant engaged in unsavory business practices or itself infringed upon patents or was dishonest. And in light of the existence of those factual allegations, the courts elected to infer that the plaintiff had intended to state a defamation claim. But no such allegations exist in this case. There are no allegations that the insured said anything negative about the claimant, GPS Industries. Everything that ProLink is alleged to have said in the underlying complaint was about the patent. Patent is property. That goes to the disparagement of property issue. That does not state a claim for defamation. We simply cannot rewrite the allegations simply to trigger coverage.
Is this definition of personal injury that limits libel and slander, in other words, defamation coverage, to persons and organizations but not goods? Is that standard in the CGL?
It actually is not. Our client, Federal Insurance Company, is a member of the Chubb group of insurance companies. Chubb has used this definition for the last 6 or 7 years or so. There are a number of other insurance companies that write policies that provide the exact opposite. They affirmatively grant coverage for disparagement of goods, property, or services. We don't do that, and we very clearly say in the policy that coverage is not extended for disparagement.
Is this intended to fill a gap that the IP exclusion wasn't filling or something like that?
I think it's an intention to redundantly address issues involving intellectual property exclusion, which is probably a good opportunity for me to talk about the intellectual property exclusion. Insurance companies simply cannot underwrite for intellectual property disputes such as those involving patent or unfair competition. The frequency and the magnitude of such claims in the last several decades have gone through the roof. IP cases and disputes cost millions and millions of dollars. They're unpredictable. They're impossible to underwrite. If an insurance company actually intended to cover a patent claim or an unfair competition claim, the premium for that policy would be astronomical.
So a patent holder can't get this kind of coverage
that
he's alleging here?
They certainly cannot get it in a general liability policy.
Okay.
Some very sophisticated companies will go out and get what we call a manuscripted policy, in which they sit down with an insurance company, reveal all of the intellectual property that they have, and develop a unique insurance vehicle that's intended just to address that.
It's highly customized.
Exactly.
To the client, and I assume expensive.
Extremely, and usually the deductibles are also very high. There are so many of these claims. Companies deal with IP issues almost on a daily basis now. This is not the kind of issue that was intended to be addressed by a general liability insurance policy. It's either a cost of doing business that an insured would deal with on its own, just like it deals with all other costs of doing business, or they attempt to get a specially crafted policy that might treat any unique circumstances that they have. So the IP exclusion expressly references both patent and unfair competition. This case, underlying case, is all about patent-related issues. There's no way to read the underlying allegations in such a way that takes it outside of the scope of the IP exclusion. In addition to specifically referencing patent and unfair competition, the policy also says that it excludes all claims that are in any way related to intellectual property laws or rights. And here we have a policyholder who apparently claimed that it had a license to transfer the patent to a bank, and then at some point claimed that it had ownership of the patent such that it could transfer the patent to the bank. Clearly, those things are related to intellectual property-related issues. Everything reverts back to the patent. If the patent didn't exist, there would be no lawsuit here. So everything is patent related. The assertion that the underlying claims are not related to patent issues because they really deal with ownership rather than intellectual property issues, I think is belied by the fact that the first assertion that was made that gives rise to this claim was made in a document that is entitled Intellectual Property Security Agreement. I think that in and of itself connects the statements that were allegedly made in that agreement to intellectual property related issues. We talked a little bit about the timing of the offense at issue. Of course, we don't believe there's an offense, but for the sake of this argument, let's assume arguendo that there is. The timing issue is treated from two different angles in the policy. First, the insuring agreement says that the offense must be first committed during the policy period, and then there's a subsequent exclusion which says if the offense was occurred before the policy period, there can be no coverage whatsoever. We think that applies here because the only policy that they have brought into this action is the policy in effect from 2007 to 2008, and the complaint very clearly alleges that the first misrepresentation as to the right to transfer the patent was made in June of 2006, well before the inception of our policy. Now, they do indeed argue that we were the insurance company on the risk before that 07-08 policy, and we have never denied that. We indeed issued that policy, but they elected to sue us only with regard to one policy. And it turns out that they now find themselves in the very awkward position of having to ask your honors to find coverage on the prior policy, which is nowhere in the record of this case. The only insurance policy that's in the record is the 07-08 policy. The 06-07 policy is not referenced anywhere. It's not attached. It's simply not in the record. We also believe the expected or intended injury exclusion applies to bar coverage here. The allegations are multiple in the complaint to the effect that the representations were made with knowledge of falsity. And in light of those allegations, we think the only appropriate conclusion is that the injury was, in fact, expected or intended by the policyholder. Finally, the insured contends that we're estopped from raising all of these issues. Estoppel only applies when there's been a breach of the duty to defend. Obviously, that has not happened here. But even if it had, estoppel is a remedy that applies to the duty to indemnify. It doesn't apply to the duty to defend. The reason that distinction is important is because the duty to indemnify is not at issue in this case. This is purely a duty to defend case. Estoppel cannot apply, and we ask your honors to affirm the judgment in favor of Federal Insurance Company.
So I understand it, what your last argument is, a policy for which coverage claimed isn't in the record.
Correct.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
In the brief time I have left, I just want to make the point, Your Honor, that much of what was described about patent coverage is not in the record, but if you read the Dish case, which cites Amazon and Hyundai, there are policies that provide coverage for patent. And the actuarial risk is no different for patent coverage than copyright, which they do grant under their policy. If you look at Excel Store Tech v. PAPS licensing, a dispute about a license to manufacture granted by a patent owner does not arise under patent law. It is not an IP right. That's a Federal Circuit published opinion. The other thing to bear in mind is, as Judge Easterbrook recently found a week ago, you can't add words of limitation to a policy. And what they're asking the court to do is that by claiming that they have any coverage that would otherwise rise for defamation is excluded if it also gives rise to disparagement. That's not what that language says in their policy. That's much too narrow a reading. It's exactly the same reading that was rejected.
Explain to me the question I just asked. Since the policy in which you're seeking coverage isn't in the record, how are we supposed to make those interpretations?
The policy we're seeking coverage under is year two. Year two is definitely in the record, as is year one, because it's referenced in their denial letter, which is part of the record and is an exhibit to the complaint, which was the basis for the motion for judgment on the pleadings. Year one policy is of no moment because the conduct at that point is not defamation that's published because it's not an injurious publication of material to merely record something. See ABM Industries v. National Union, a Ninth Circuit case of 2008 WL 3992334 at asterisk 1, where tenant estoppel certificates setting forth a legal
counsel,
opinion
if
didn't
I could
include
interrupt
a defense.
For a minute, most of the cases that you've cited in your brief and have alluded to in oral argument are not Illinois insurance cases, and I think it's stipulated here that Illinois law applies.
Unless there's a conflict, in which case Arizona law applies, Your Honor.
But there isn't.
Well, let's talk about Blue Sky Bio, which is a federal district court opinion applying Illinois law, and it found federal insurance policies did not provide that an advertising injury claim is excluded from coverage if the underlying claim but also asserts a patent infringement claim. So there you had patent plus another claim, and they tried to argue that it was so interrelated that the IP exclusion that we have here applies. Court found no.
That doesn't have anything to do with what law applies. Illinois insurance law applies here.
Correct. And Blue Sky is a district
court. So if you would confine yourself
court,
to Illinois.
Well, I decided the district court opinion in Illinois applying Illinois law. Okay. That would lose that,
is there anything, any Seventh Circuit precedential
opinion? Yes, the case I first cited you this
Illinois
morning,
law.
Republic Tobacco North Atlantic, an opinion of this court in 2004 that affirmed judgment for defamation where the defendant falsely claimed that Painter was violating its patent and trademark rights, which case is cited in NVIDIA, a district court opinion in 2005.
Did any of those cases have any of these same exclusions or the same policy language in the coverage grant that we were discussing earlier, the definition of the definition of personal injury that excludes product disparagement?
Yes, the exact same policy was interpreted against Federal in NVIDIA Corp., which relied on the Republic Tobacco case, 2005 case, relying on a 2004 case. And I invite the Court to look at NVIDIA very carefully because it's quite analogous. It's also analogous to a subsequent opinion from the Ninth Circuit, which applies factually. And he's made some statements that there are no slander of title claims that are analogous that have found also defamation and disparagement. Again, I urge you to look at Limetree and BankWest. Yes, they are not Illinois opinions, but they may have persuasive value to this court as they are published opinions from other courts, federal courts of appeal.
Thank you, Counselor. Whoop. I'm sorry, your time has now expired.
Thank you.
Thanks to both counsel. The case will be taken under advisement, and we move.